Here's the old story about the commissioner of the U.S. Patent Office saying there was no need for the office anymore because everything that can be invented has been. Turns out the story's not true, and the concept could certainly never have been true. Just look at the last 30 years. If you were around in 1986, did you have a typewriter in your house? Did your phone have a cord? You sure could not send text messages on that phone or watch movies on it, but both those things are possible with phones you carry in your pocket now. Our guest this hour looks at what could happen over the next 30 years. Kevin Kelly is the author of The Inevitable, Understanding the 12 Technological Forces That Will Shape Our Future. Kevin is the editor-at-large at Wired, which he co-founded 23 years ago. Kevin is a deep thinker about what's next and has written several books about the future, including New Rules for the New Economy and Out of Control, which he describes as very long, very complex, very broad, and hard to summarize, and it's available on the web for free. Kevin Kelly, thanks for joining us on The Exchange today.
Hey, it's my pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
How hard was it to limit this book to the 12 technological forces that shape the chapters?
It was difficult because, in fact, there are many more subcurrents, and these are kind of like braided together like kind of a river stream, and you could kind of cut these in different ways, somewhat arbitrary, but they're all pointing in the same direction.
Well, for that matter, how daunting was it to call it the inevitable, given the obvious dangers of predicting the future?
Yes, we're usually wrong about those kinds of things. I use the word inevitable in the way that we would imagine rain falling into a valley and the drop of the path of a drop of water as it goes down towards the river is completely unpredictable, but the general direction is inevitable, which is downward. And so I'm talking about these large scale currents that are the general form and not the particulars. So the way I would say it is, you know, telephones were inevitable once you invented electricity and wires. But the iPhone was not. The Internet was inevitable, but Twitter was not. So I'm talking about these large-scale things.
Okay. So there's an interesting personal story right up front about the technology and you. You apparently were not impressed by computers when you saw them as a younger person. What changed?
Well, I was 12 years old. It was 1965, and the computers I was looking at were in this hall, and they were the size of rooms, basically. They were metal cabinets that stretched on forever, and they were totally boring. I mean, all they did was there was a keyboard, and then they printed out paper with numbers on them, and that was it. And you know, I had been reading science fiction for 3 years by then, and I knew what the computers were, and you know, you talk to them, they would have pictures, and so these were not real computers, and we didn't really have real computers even after the standalone desktops like the Apple IIs came along. I think computers changed into what we now know them when we plugged them into the telephone, when they communicated to each other, when they became social in that way, and much more kind of alive. And so I think the standalone computer doesn't really do very much, but once we had the network of them, that's where all the magic has happened.
You know, when you think about it, when you think about things like the fact that people love to get together and talk about, or used to anyway, to get together and talk about the TV shows they watch, that there was always a social component to telecommunications anyway. It seems like the Internet should have dawned on somebody maybe a little sooner than it did.
Yeah, you would have thought so. But of course, it was happening in the background. There was the Internet for almost 10 or 20 years before most people became aware of it, and it was because it was text only, and you needed to have a little bit of programming smarts to be able to get online. So this was the early bulletin boards and things like that, which appealed to a certain subset of the culture. But they were using it, and they were being very, very social, and I, who was on, couldn't convince people that, hey, this is going to be mainstream. This is not just about pimply kids sitting in the basement with a green screen. No, this was about society. It didn't really dawn on until people could see it visually, and that was the browser. So when Netscape and the web came along, suddenly people said, oh, I get it. I see it now. And that was the real turning point.
Yeah, we can trade things. We can show our stuff. We can have show and tell online all the time is what it started out looking like with the web anyway. There are a bunch of phrases that really make you stop and think as a reader here. And one of them is our ability to invent new things outpaces the rate at which we can civilize them. What does that mean?
Well, I use the word civilize or domesticate in the sense that most of what we invent, we actually don't really know what it's going to be used for in the end. I have a famous story of Thomas Edison, the prolific inventor who invented so many things, including the phonograph. And when he, after the night after he kind of got the phonograph to work, the first version of it, he sat down to talk to make a list to himself of what he thought this recording sound instrument would be used for. And the very top of his list was you could record the last words of the dying. And the second thing was, oh, maybe you could use it to disseminate sermons. And he kind of kept going down, and the final thing on his list was, you know, maybe you might use it for music. So he really didn't know what this was going to be used for. And that's generally true for all these kinds of inventions. It takes a while for us to kind of find their jobs in civilization, because in the beginning they're kind of wild. They're a little bit feral. And so they're kind of doing things that we're not really sure that we want them to do. And I think that's true of even like social media right now. You know, social media is only 2,000 days old, less than 2,000 days old.
Really?
And so I think we're still domesticating it. We're still civilizing it.
Hmm. You talk about the heartbreak, conflict, and confusion that come with all these new devices, including incredible benefits. And it's interesting, though, when you talk about the pushback, like what Hollywood and the music business did in response to people being able to get copies of their stuff for free.
You know, this is kind of one of the points of the book is copying is inevitable. The fact that this technology has an innate tendency to copy things. It's baked into the very nature of chips and wires and switches, and that it wants to copy, and it will copy, and you can't stop the copying. You can kind of only work with it. And so for 30 years, the music industry and Hollywood to some extent has tried to stop copying through technological means, through legal laws, by arresting their best customers. It's been proved ineffective. They would have done much better by accepting the fact that you have to kind of work with the copies.
It's interesting to think, though, in so many different things that have cropped up through history, that of course people were going to try to look for ways to make their own or make them better, or, you know, because of the things like Edison, where he didn't even think it could be used for music when he invented the phonograph. Lots more to talk about. The book is called The Inevitable: Understanding the 12 Technological Forces That Will Shape Our Future. Kevin Kelly is the author and our guest on The Exchange. We'll come back and talk more with him and take phone calls and emails from you in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Kevin Kelly, editor-at-large at Wired, the author of several books about the world we live in today and how fast it's changing and what can happen in the future. His latest book is about the future. It's called The Inevitable: Understanding the 12 Technological Forces That Will Shape Our Future. And yes, he admitted it was difficult to limit it to 12, but he's talking about general concepts of things that will be happening in the years ahead. And you can join the conversation on The Exchange. Give us your thoughts about what you think we'll see in the future, how you think we'll be using the tools of today differently tomorrow, perhaps. Join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. And Becca in Lane County sent an email getting back to you about what you said about computers, the old big ones. She said, "Funny, I made a good living for many years on those old, quote, unreal computers, big iron." Then she puts a smiley face. So that's from Becca in Lane County. Kevin, what's the lesson for all of us, would you say, overall in how to approach the onslaught of new technology?
I think we have to take the stance that we're going to be forever perpetual newbies, meaning that despite as much as we might have mastered the current slate of technology and devices in our lives, in 2 years from now, we're going to have to learn a whole new set. And then 2 years after that, another new set, new gestures, new interfaces, new commands, and that for the rest of our lives, that's going to be part of what we're doing. And if we're interested in making work out of it, we're going to have to be learning, you know, new languages, new techniques constantly. So lifelong learning, that long holy grail of all educators, is going to become more and more important. You have to be able to really become better at learning new things and maybe sometimes unlearning what you thought you already knew. And so this stance of and then we shouldn't be ashamed of it, this idea that, yeah, we don't know We can't do things. We have to ask stupid questions. That's okay. That's we're all in the same state together.
The chapters are arranged as a series of verbs: becoming, cognifying, flowing, screening, accessing. For the first five, what's the intention here?
It's to indicate that there is a sense in which these are ongoing and continuous motion, continuous process. But more importantly, one of the major shifts that we are engaged in right now as a culture is a movement from the things which are solid and made out of materials and are nouns and are products to things that are soft and liquid and verbs. And our services. So we have to shift from nouns to from products to services. We have to shift from things that are solid to things that are flowing, and that's that flowing liquidity. We can see it on the screen. I mean, we were people of the book, which were fixed and solid and precise, and the authors gave us authority. And now we're people of the screen, where things are kind of flowing across, the little pixels skid across the glass, and everything is ephemeral. We have streams of music and streams of movies and updates and walls that flow up. And so there is a sense in which everything is kind of flowing. And so the book is reflecting, the title is that this has impacts on all the aspects of our lives, this kind of constant process rather than products.
So in chapter one, becoming, who or what is becoming what else?
Everything is becoming something else. The science has sort of taught us that even the sun is in the process of becoming something, and there's long-term evolution, and technologically we're obviously in a very rapid process of moving from one thing to the next thing, and even our own human natures, we now understand, have been changing, that we ourselves have changed our own genes, our own physical bodies over the last 10,000 years. And so then, of course, obviously our surroundings, the stuff that we make is rapidly changing from one thing to the next. And so we have these constant upgrades. We have these versions of stuff. We have this sense that we're on this path that we have to keep moving. And so that's everything.
You know, it's interesting too when you talk about what that means, particularly in the realm of upgrades. How we're always getting a different version of our software, or gee, the firmware doesn't work anymore, or you know, the whole thing itself is obsolete in a couple of years. Certainly with computers, but you talk about if you don't go along with the flow day by day and take the upgrades, after a while you end up so out of date that your stuff isn't going to function anyway.
Yeah. It's sort of like you have this kind of dilemma of like you want to be constantly upgrading, or do you want to wait and then have this catastrophic upgrade where nothing works after because you're so far behind, and then you have to upgrade everything at once. So I changed my mind. I used to be kind of like the last minute guy, you know, you'll have to pry my hands to upgrade, and then I realized that was far more painful. That it was actually easier to do the kind of, you know, the hygienic way where you're kind of flossing every day. You're kind of upgrading all the time. And that was better than these trips to the dentist where you have to upgrade your entire life at once. So I think of course, there's lots of things in between. And but the point is that it's inescapable in a certain sense. You can kind of do it any way you want, but in the end, we have to kind of keep moving forward. And this idea of becoming is sort of embedded into the entire book because it applies to all the things that we see coming down the pike, from virtual reality to artificial intelligence. We have to get ready for these.
Another one of these phrases that jumps out: I celebrate the never-ending discontentment that technology brings. Good God, why?
Because it's the source of all the benefits that we have now. Our restless inclination to tinker, to ask what if, to say I could make this a little bit better. This is a new desire that I didn't know that we had. I mean, this desire to walk around with your phone looking for Pokemon outside in the park.
Right.
That has never existed before, and now people can't help themselves. I just find that wonderful because it taps into something about ourselves that we didn't know that is allowing us to express things in a way that we had never imagined. And it ultimately, that will be the source of something we consider fundamental. Like, you know, we can't live without being connected today. That was something we invented out of, you know, some crazy guys in the basements were fiddling around with electricity, and that has led to this. And so I think I think we should celebrate this desire to explore. It's a type of exploration, to explore, to see what the universe contains and what the possibilities are.
So while we're busy looking forward, or looking at Pokemon Go now, and I'm glad those guys who walked off a cliff in Encinitas were okay. I guess they had a soft landing on the beach below. But so let's talk about your own perceptions. And I wonder, like, how many of the things that you thought would happen 30 years ago have come to pass, particularly where, as involved as you were in the creation of online content, if it has turned out like you thought it would.
Did it turn out? Well, it turned out very differently in many ways. I mean, like a lot of people at the very beginning of the Internet, we were kind of imagining, you know, there was, when I grew up, there was 3 or 4 TV stations. You had that's your selection was 5 maybe. And you could kind of like imagine, oh, someday there might be 5,000 channels. And we actually talked about that the Internet might bring 5,000 channels or whatever. But what we didn't expect, that what was not sort of in anybody's scenario, including, I have to say, maybe the people at Wired, where I was this idea that that would not just be 5,000 channels, it would be like 5 million channels, and that they all would be produced by the audience. That this idea that the giant portion of the stuff that we would look at during the day would not come from big media companies, but would come from your friends. And that the friends would have TV channels in their bedrooms, that they would be producing hours and hours of video, and that many, 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 many people would watch and subscribe to them. That seemed literally impossible. I mean, we talked about that a little bit, but it was hard to believe. And because all the TV people said, you know how much trouble it is to make video? That's amateur. 12-year-olds can't do that. Well, the thing is that the tools just became so easy, and then the distribution became it was just a click away. And so that is what we have, and that's not what we really expected.
Kevin Kelly's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His latest book is called The Inevitable, Understanding the 12 Technological Forces That Will Shape Our Future. You can join us at 800-838-3760 as we muse about what might come down the road the next 30 years, or more generally, which is the way he phrases his book, the kinds of things that will happen, although he's not talking about specific inventions necessarily. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Before we leave the mistakes that people made about the Internet, I do want to have you tell the story about what happened when you had a meeting with the folks at ABC and talked about the possibilities of the Internet.
Yeah, so this vision of the Internet, which at that time was very scarce, a few academics, a couple corporations, and then some teenage kids were using it. And I made a presentation to ABC that in the corner suite, the executives there, telling them, look, this is in the mid-90s, I'm saying this is coming. This is going to be very mainstream. This is not going to be marginal. This is going to be something, and people will get off their couch and actually make video and make materials. And they just couldn't see it. They made this argument that it was just, they were professionals. They knew how much work it was. It was just not going to happen. And so I left saying, well, you know, I don't think you feel like you've gotten your money's worth, but I have something that I think will make my visit worthwhile, which is I happen to know that you've not registered ABC.com. This was very early in the days, and then they had no idea what I was talking about. And I said, well, you go downstairs, get your most techie guy in the basement, and tell him to register ABC.com, and my fee will be worthwhile. And I went checked a week later, and they still hadn't done it. So, you know, it was like it's like an alien from another planet trying to talk. And you know, it's not, again, I don't want to blame the TV people, because people had difficulty seeing what it was because it seemed so impossible. Wikipedia is impossible, yet there it is. And some of the things coming down the line, you know, artificial intelligence, it seems a little kind of like, you know, really? The self-driving car? They're really going to drive? I mean, I'm going to sleep in a car? That seems a little kind of impossible. But, yeah, it's going to come pretty soon.
And indeed. And I want to get to artificial intelligence pretty soon, but I want to take some calls here from, let's start with Wolfgang in Sunny Valley. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Kevin Kelly.
Good morning.
Hi.
Kevin. Keyword artificial intelligence. I was working in artificial intelligence in 86, and I had a paperless office in 84. So I'm sort of pretty avant-garde. But, and then in order to, I mean, I'm expanding the scope of what I'm looking at from the myopic. What can I get? Who do what illusion talking to whom can I get, how fast and all that. Let's look at the larger picture, and that's follow the money. And then you look at who are the richest guys in the world. That's Bill Gates, and that's people who sell illusion, telecommunication, fashion, and all that. It is illusions. It is something that if you turn off the power, you don't have anything. So it's an isolation we are selling. We are selling an illusion. And I think that that is it. Why would so many millions of people who do videos, who do they do it for? They do it for the people who want to advertise on Facebook. Mm-hmm. So it's we are feeding like little robots. We are feeding into a system that makes the Gates and the Slims in the world richer and richer and richer. And
okay, let's get a response. Thanks for that, Wolfgang. Appreciate it. So, is it that centralized? Are we just putting hands in the money in the hands of people who already have plenty of it, or is it more democratic than that? What do you see, Kevin?
Right now, I think he's right in the sense that one of the rocket fuels for the AI, as it's currently being used, is big data. And so it's the companies with the biggest data that actually all have the AI that works, because the current neural net model needs a lot of data to work. You have to train it with millions of examples. And so it is centralized, and I think some of those companies will become even bigger, because if you have an AI that works, more people want to use that one. And the more people that use it, you're training it more, so it becomes smarter. And the more smarter it gets, the more people want to use it. So there is that dynamic right now where I think the biggest AI companies in the first round will be some of the biggest companies. However, the thing about learning is that humans, like a human baby, a toddler, only needs a training set of like 12 examples to tell the difference between a cat and a dog. So there's a whole new frontier available for somebody, some small startup, to invent a way to do AI that requires almost no training sets at all, or very, very small. And that will just leapfrog the old. The old will just tumble and be displaced by the new. So the thing is that in the network world, there are things where there's a dominance player. They call it network effects, where the rich get richer. But the thing about those is they're very temporary. In terms of the span of decades, it's a temporary monopoly. So while the current Gates and Larry Page will get richer, they have only a short time before they're displaced by some other radical startup that will do something 10 times better or 100 times better.
So you mentioned the how AI picks things up with lots and lots of examples, and it's certainly gotten good enough to learn like how to play video games and actually find the things that even the developers didn't intend in there, as you point out in the book. What else can it do, though? And are you concerned about the singularity that people talk about, where essentially the machines become smarter than us?
Well, first of all, to answer your first question, what else can it do? It can do many things, and it's already right now doing many things in the back offices that you're not aware of. Of course, if you're using Netflix or Amazon, those recommendations are an example of AI, though we don't think of it. So a lot of the AI will become a commodity, kind of a utility like electricity. It'll be very boring. It's like industrial. It's happening. There's no interface to it that we as consumers are even aware of. There will be some outward-facing, consumer-facing AI, and that will look more like conversational bots, your Siri, your Amazon Echo Alexia, where you talk to that, that's probably going to be the interface for AI, is a conversation or your gestures, where you're asking it questions. It's kind of your virtual assistant. That's what most people will see first. But the question about how far can it go is it can go pretty far. But the thing I want to emphasize is that these agents, even at their best, will think differently than humans. Our intelligence is not a single dimension like IQ. It's erroneous. We have multiple kinds of intelligences in our own brain. We have social intelligence. We have deductive reasoning. We have all these different types of intelligences. And some of them are stronger with an artificial intelligence and some are weaker. So you can't really say something is smarter than humans. Well, you could. You could say your calculator is smarter than you are in arithmetic. You know, Google's smarter than you are in long-term memory. And so I think the idea that these are going to take over is erroneous idea of our intelligence, because we're going to make 1,000 different types of thinking, and they're all going to be slightly different. The reason why we want our cars to have AI driving them is because they don't drive like humans. They're not being distracted. The benefit is that they aren't like us, and that's why we're going to use them.
And so then we can look down at our phones and be texting our friends, and the car is handling itself at the same time, which, believe me, can be a good thing some days. The Inevitable is the book. Kevin Kelly is the author, and we'll come back and talk more with him and take more phone calls and emails from you when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are now half an hour further into the future than we were when we started this conversation about the future with Kevin Kelly, editor-at-large at Wired, the author of several books about the world and technology and the future. His latest is called The Inevitable, Understanding the 12 Technological Forces That Will Shape Our Future. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we muse about what might be. He talks in rather general terms, but we can talk specifics as well about the things you think we'll be able to do with the gadgets we have now, or the gadgets we'll have that we don't have now. And how will we relate to each other amidst all the gadgets? 800-838-3760 for your thoughts by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So it sounds like one of the mistakes we make is this general societal thinking that AI will be like us. It won't necessarily. I mean, we're talking about just machines don't operate quite the way that, well, as you mentioned, our calculator is smarter than us in math already.
Yeah, that I think is an inherent fallacy of promoted in many ways by Hollywood and other extreme science fiction worlds where they're human-like. And I think this is very, very unlikely, they being the AIs are human-like, because it turns out that you can't really make a particular kind of thinking. It depends on the matrix, the substrate that it's on. So if you want to have a really human-like intelligence, you have to have biological tissue doing it. And so that's possible maybe in the far future, but at least within the 30-year horizon, when we make these on silicon, they're going to be thinking differently. And again, as I said, that's a benefit, because there may be some really tough problems in business or in science that maybe our own human kind of intelligence alone is not sufficient. And so we may have to do a two-step solution, which is to kind of invent a different kind of mind that can think differently, maybe even more scientifically than us, that we work together with to solve these problems.
You know, I get that robots will continue to replace factory jobs as time goes on, for sure, physical jobs. But you point out, too, that white-collar jobs more white-collar jobs are likely to go as well. I mean, obviously, clerical things where people were adding up numbers before and moving stacks of paper around, those I'm sure can be handled by machinery now, too. But what else do you see in the way of white-collar jobs going off to computers and robots?
Well, there's jobs right now. Like, it turns out that AI is a much better at diagnosing medical x-rays than doctors. A lot of the legal evidentiary work has gone from paralegals to AI. You know, flying an airplane on a long-haul flight across the country, the human pilots are only flying for 7 to 8 minutes. The rest of the time, the AI is driving. And so it's really huge in terms of the kinds of jobs. Mortgage brokers, basically any kind of a job that where efficiency is being measured, where productivity matters. These are the kinds of jobs, whether they're physical or knowledge work, that's going to go to the bots. And what we're kind of left with are the jobs where efficiency is not so important, which, by the way, is really good because we like to waste time. And so what those kinds of jobs are like science is basically inherently, fundamentally inefficient because you're making one failure after another. You have experiments that don't work. That's how you learn. Innovation is inherently inefficient because you are trying stuff that doesn't work. You're exploring, which is not efficient. You have dead ends. And I think art is inefficient. Human relationships, for that matter, are inherently inefficient. So these are all the things that we're going to gravitate to, things in which human relationships are important. Robots don't do well there because they're made and invented to be efficient. So what it is our jobs have different tasks, and some of those tasks are related to efficiency. Those tasks go to the bots and redefines our jobs. So there are a lot of jobs that will remain, but they'll be redefined because a lot of the tasks will go. And what we're going to do is we're going to end up working with the AIs. In fact, you may even be paid by how well you work with AIs, in the sense that they'll do the things that we don't want to do or can't do very well. And other aspects of our jobs will be rewarded and will grow in there. And so this is the idea that we're going to be working with these machines rather than against them.
Another phone call here. Let's go to Deborah in Talent. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Kevin Kelly, the author of The Inevitable.
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah, Kevin made a statement earlier that I want to comment on. He said, who knew that people were going to want to be so connected all the time? I believe that that is the human condition. I believe that we are species-oriented in that direction, and that this is just another way, perhaps, of satisfying that need, but it is not new.
Fair point, but this the kind of connection we have now where you're waking up in the middle of the night to text your friends back on the East Coast. Is that the kind of connection you thought we would have been reaching for?
What I'm saying is people need to be connected. So how we go about connecting may change over time, but the actual need has not changed.
Okay, let's get a take from Kevin on that. Thanks so much, Deborah.
I agree 100% that we are social animals, that we invented, even at the beginning of our humanity, it was because we were social and we learned how to cooperate. And what I see technology doing is increasing the ways and the variety in ways in which we can connect. I think that you're right that the fundamental urge to connect is hardwired long into us before we even became humans, social animals, but that what we're inventing and what we didn't sort of maybe realize is how much we want to be connected, how deep that would go, so that as Jeffrey says, that we are connected to each other all the time, which, by the way, was not really how people lived even 200 years ago, because I was in the time machine and I went back to the past in northern Afghanistan in the 70s and in Nepal where they were living like they did a couple hundred years ago. And it was surprising that people were around a few other people some of the day, but you know, a lot of the shepherd boys would go out and they would see no other humans for the whole day, and the farmer would go out, and they were not actually as connected in terms of the amount of time they spent with other people. They weren't connected to as many people. So this is, the need is there, but we're actually realizing it in new ways, and that's what we didn't realize, is how deep that desire was.
Okay, another question from email from Vajra in Sunny Valley about humans versus machines here. She says, the guest speaks of exploring the universe with technology. What is lost in this approach is the timeless exploration of reality through meditation and shamanic journeying, which is more real than most people think, she says, and communing with nature and the universe. It is an established fact that indigenous people learned what medicine plants had to offer by dreaming and communing with the plants. In other words, the plants told them. You won't get that through technology, writes Vajra in Sunny Valley, and asks, what might we be losing through depending upon technology?
Yeah, I think there are costs I'm not a utopian. I'm a protopian, meaning that I think technology can make as many new problems as it solves, but that there's even if we are able to create only a 1% more than we destroy every year, that very slow, tiny difference accumulated over time is worthwhile. So we do lose some things. We do lose some knowledge over time. But I think the additional benefits that we gain are compensated. So I at the same time, I want to retain as much of that knowledge as possible and connect it to everything else. And so I think I honor those who are trying to save that knowledge, to keep it going, and to integrate it into everything else we know. So this, we want to save as much as we can, but sometimes we do lose things.
You tick off a list of cognified things and operations, which is really interesting. We had talked about the Internet of Things with other authors in the past from the MIT Media Lab, among other things, like the umbrellas that blink on the days when it's going to rain, that sort of thing. But you've got cognified laundry in here, for example. What do you see happening there?
Yeah. So the idea is that we're at the precipice of a vast opening of opportunity. This whole continent before us is where we can take almost anything and add AI to it. And it seems strange at first, but in some senses, the more kind of weird the thing that you add artificial intelligence to, the more powerful it is. So let's take something like you can hard imagine. Let's take taxis. Do you take taxi cabs and you add AI? And what do you get? You get Uber. So the idea is that, you know, you take laundry and add AI. So maybe you have something where you have smart shirts that tell the washing machine how they should be laundered or how many times they've been laundered and it changes over time. Or maybe they are aware of how dirty they are and they can actually give specified laundry instructions. Or maybe they actually contain, in some ways, some intelligence that they could help your posture. Just sit differently because they're aware of how you fit into the laundry thing itself, the clothes itself. So there's an entire realm of unexplored possibilities in every single thing in our life if you imagine making them smarter, just as we have in the past made them electrified.
Well, you know, and you just mentioned taxis and Uber and point out in the book that here you have the largest taxi company in the world that doesn't own a single car, which then gets us into the whole realm of actually it's in the chapter called Accessing about dematerialization, the idea that we're going to be doing a lot more sharing. I mean, do you envision a future in 30 years when we could really own nothing?
I think that's really hard to imagine. I did do a scenario where I postulated an extreme version just to illustrate the fact that on average, we will own less. Somebody at some point has to own the cars that are being auto-driven around. So, but it may not be individuals. It may be just companies that own them. But I think individually, we will own less, although we will probably continue to own something that we care about. The vision of how we own less is that as things become more liquid, as things become less of a product and more of a service, that those services can flow to us very quickly. Maybe they're they're an on-demand delivery. You can get something within an hour. Maybe you can get them digitally through your phone or your desktop. The idea is that if you can have something instantly, no matter where you are, then summoning it and having it is in many ways better than owning it because you don't have to upgrade it. You don't have to store it. You don't have to catalog it. You don't have to maintain it. You don't have to clean it. You don't have to do these many things. And so actually just having access to something, using it, and then leaving it behind or having it be taken away is in many ways superior to actually owning it. And so there's many things in our lives today that we no longer have an impulse to own, like, say, movies or music or maybe even games, where if we can get access to it, that's better. And I think even physical things, like a car, may go the way of that, where we don't own cars. We summon a car that's there instantly, takes us to where it is. We don't have to park it. There's actually no parking because the cars are just moving all the time. They're always moving someone. And so the parking spaces are used for new things. But the idea is that you will own less because we can deliver the same service as something that you have access to instead of own.
Do you see some of this happening, Kevin, because it's cool, and or some of it happening because it's necessary, because as resources become scarcer, perhaps, that there won't be as much metal for cars or something, so that we'll have to share things?
It's not that I think we can always substitute, but it is something that it is more ecologically sound. But I think at the same time is we are making so many new things, and if you extrapolate, like how many songs or products we've invented in the last even 30 years, and you look forward to how many more we're going to invent in the next 30 years, the numbers are just so vast that we don't have room in our houses for all these things. We don't have room in our lives for all these things. And so in some senses, for us to even touch all these new products, we simply can't own all of them. There's not enough room. And so we have access to them, and we may have them, you know. So it's like, how many times do you need a deep fryer?
Uh-huh.
you know, you may use it once a year, but why not have that kind of delivered to you at the moment you need it? You use it, and then it's taken away. You don't have to clean it. Okay, that's much better than owning it. And so there's lots of things in our lives that we are only using occasionally. And as we have more and more choices, if we have another million things to choose from, the idea of accessing it just becomes much more practical.
Just really a few seconds left. Was there one particular prediction you might have made in your career that you're most proud of?
That's a great question.
Or most ashamed of, huh?
Well, yeah, you could go both ways. I was talking about the fact that from the very beginning, way back when Amazon started, and particularly at the height of Amazon, when all the bookstores were shivering that they were going to kill them, I was saying, look, Amazon's going to come out with a bookstore, a physical bookstore eventually. And that's the reason is because bookstores are actually a really good invention, a great way to see and understand books. And so the idea is you take the digital world and you put it into the physical world, you meld the two together. And that's no better example than Pokemon Go, which is this combination. So I think the future is not just all this digital stuff, separate lives. It's where we take the digital and we put it into the real world. And that's what we're going to see more of.
All right. The book is called The Inevitable. Kevin Kelly, its author, our guest. Kevin, thanks a lot.
It's really a pleasure. It was so much fun being here. Thanks for having me.
All right. Take care.